Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Robbie Butler, who is a lecturer at University College Cork and is an expert in sports economics. So most of us are at least casual sports fans, but the big question on many minds is probably, where does the economics come into play? And sport is interesting from an economics perspective because you can get insight into what's going on in the context of the sport itself, but you can use that context to help test other economic theories. And Robbie takes us through his research, which has covered a number of interesting topics. We discuss Fergie time, where it was rumoured that Premier League referees were giving extra time when Alex Ferguson's Man United were playing. We discuss the use of bonus points in rugby and whether they provided the intended incentives or whether they created perverse incentives. And we discuss whether pundits are actually better than the average fan when it comes to predicting a result. Now, any sports fan listening will think this is very exciting and will be looking forward to hearing what Robbie has to say. But those who are less into their sport will probably be wondering, is there something here for the hardcore economists too? Well, much of what we discuss touches on economic theories of labour productivity, agency theory, and cognitive biases when it comes to predicting outcomes and decision making. So hopefully there's something here for everybody. Before we get stuck in, let me remind you that I have a Patreon at www.patreon.com/IrishEconPod. If you enjoy this podcast to the value of a cup of coffee a month, then consider becoming a Patreon and helping to secure the future of the podcast. Okay, I hope you enjoy this conversation.
I suppose the good place to start off is basically thinking about sports economics and an introduction to that and what exactly that entails. And if you could tell us what exactly you guys do when it comes to, how did you get into it in the first place, I suppose, would be interesting. And then what exactly it entails.
When I was doing my master's a long time ago now, nearly 20 years ago now, I took an interest in research in sport. So my master's thesis looked at efficient market hypothesis in betting betting odds in Ireland. So we looked at a number of race courses and we tried to see whether or not the odds that were prevailing in the market during the and before the off of a race and when the race started, whether they were able to predict the outcome of the result. So I guess that was my first foray ever into it. And I never anticipated then that, I never anticipated I'd stay in academia because I really didn't know what I would do. I was just looking for jobs like everybody in my class at the time. And because I was fortunate to find work in academia, it then kind of opened up and I just started to kind of dabble in it a little bit. And again, horse racing was where I originally started. So we started looking at how prize money was funded in horse racing. And that's over 10 years ago now. And then I guess I started to blog on it. And we have a blog that's running over 7 years now, sportseconomics.org. And it's as blogs go, it's quite popular. Some of the guys in UCC then, David, my brother, John Considine, John Eakins, Declan Jordan, started the blog too. And it kind of really took off from there because people like yourself started to take notice.
Yeah.
And what started off as kind of just us having a bit of fun with sport and economics turned into something then that we could actually, first of all, research and for the last 4 years now teach in UCC. So in many ways, it's taken on a life of its own.
It's interesting you mentioned...
Natural progression.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned like efficient market hypothesis. It's a nice example of where you have something that happens in a sports context, but has a nice economic, you know, framework around it. And you can use that sort of toolkit to explain what's going on and to try and get some insight. That sort of, I suppose, frames a lot of what you do. Would that be correct?
Yeah. So I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because there's two things that you can look at. There's sports economics, and then there's economics through sport. Now, it might sound like the same thing, but they're slightly different. So sports economics looks at economic issues in a sport. So you look at competition in the Premier League or competitive balance in hurling. So you're actually looking at the sport and trying to understand an economic issue. The second aspect is you want to try and understand something in economics, like moral hazard, like labor productivity, like efficient market.
Yeah.
In order to understand that, you just use sport. And that's the beauty of it, because it can be used either way. So I guess the best thing about sport in many ways is the abundance of data that is there, and not only there, that's freely available.
Yeah.
There's things we know about sports people that we don't know about any other industry. So if you look at a rugby player or a football player or, you know, professional athletes in North America, basketball, baseball or whatever, you can tell instantly their record of employment, who they played for, how long they played for, what their productivity was. So how many times they got on base, how many home runs they got, you know, how many shots they score, how many shots they miss, you know, how many kicks they make at conversions. So because that information is there and it's public, you're able to then measure things like productivity. So if you want to do that for any other industry in the economy, you'd find it extremely difficult to do that, because accessing the data would be problematic. And then when you access the data, would it be possible then to match it up with other data that you might acquire in order to answer the question? And I think that's one of the big benefits of using sports data.
Yeah, because it's there. You hit something that I always think about. You think it's like, I do like research in environment and looking at innovation in that context sometimes. And a lot of innovations that come through, for example, electric vehicles, came out of motorsport, because you have this purely competitive environment. I need to win this, so I need to develop and innovate and things like that. So in a sense, it strips out all the other noise when it comes into other markets.
So that's really interesting that you mentioned Formula One, because I never thought of it that way, the competitive nature. But I think what it does and what sport does and what you mentioned there is you have a somewhat controlled environment, right, whereby you can actually look at an economic issue under certain parameters. So if you try to look at an issue in the motor industry in general, so you look at people driving on the road or something like that, it's difficult because there's so many moving parts. But you take it to a more extreme environment where you have 22 cars on a circuit for X number of laps.
Yeah.
And they do that repeatedly then through time. There's things you don't need to concern yourself with that you would if you just did that at a level of the general population. And as I said, that brings you back to the point that you can look at economic issues through the lens of sport. So one of the papers we had accepted most recently looks at labour productivity, but we used the Heineken Cup in rugby. We looked from 1996 to 2014 when the competition ended, and we look at the introduction of the bonus point in 2003. So the bonus point was a mechanism introduced by Heineken Cup organisers to try and encourage the most attractive, exciting point scoring mechanism, which is a try. Because people that watch rugby or people that watch it casually will tell you, well, you know, when tries happen, it's more exciting than when a game is a lot of kicking or a lot of action is up front. So if you free-flowing rugby with lots of tries. So that's what the bonus point was an attempt to do. And what we've done is to look at, well, did this actually work? Did it encourage teams to score more tries? And then importantly, once the target was reached, did teams then reduce their effort, because general labor theory will tell you, well, once the bonus is achieved or once a target is reached, what generally happens is that workers then just begin to shirk. They begin to, you know, ease off a little. Yeah. But our evidence, what we found at least anyway, is no evidence of that. So it has worked as a mechanism to encourage more tries in the Heineken Cup, despite the fact that tries are now more scarce in rugby than they were 20 years ago. So there is less try scoring. It's probably a combination of professionalism, you know, really taking root and, you know, taking 20, 25 years, and also tactics. So better coaching, better tactics, particularly of weaker teams, where they're now able to aim better teams more effectively. And you don't just see this in rugby, you see this in soccer as well, particularly international soccer. You know, you think back, I remember as a child watching Ireland. Ireland, Turkey 4-5 in Lansdowne Road qualifying for the World Cup in 1990. Ireland would regularly beat teams 3-4-5 weaker teams. And despite the fact Ireland are probably weaker than they were, it's rare you see a team come to the Aviva now and be beaten. In fact, it's rare in international football. Yeah. And even, you know, Minnows, the likes of, you know, Andorra. they sort of have a, you know, they're just better drilled. So the rugby findings are interesting because we find no evidence of shirking. We find no evidence of slacking off. They'll reach four when they get to four. Yeah, there's no decline in the number of tries thereafter.
And what sort of method did you use then to try and estimate those effects?
So we have a marginal effects model. So it's a probate model and it looks at the marginal effects. So what you need to do, well, there's a number of tests you need to run. The first of all, we do before, after, and then we do within game. So before a game starts, how likely are they to score four tries? That's the first hypothesis. And then we split that home away because it's important to factor in that, you know, there are other mechanisms and other incentive structures just in the bonus point. And home away is one of the most prevalent, particularly in rugby, and particularly in the Heineken Cup, where winning away from home is quite difficult. And you'll find that through time. I would caveat that when teams generally play the Italian teams away from home, they generally tend to win the stronger teams. But Munster and Leinster and, you know, most of the Irish provinces do find playing away from home more challenging. And the same is true then when the French and the English in particular come to Ireland. It's more difficult. So we break it down home away. We look at before the game, how likely are they to score more four tries? And we test that effect. Then we test the effect. If they've scored three tries, how likely are they to score the fourth? And that's within game. So if the game is being played and they've reached three tries, well, will they get the bonus? And then we also look at, well, within game, if they've scored four tries, how likely are they to score the fifth? And that's basically how the paper is set up.
The likelihood of getting the fourth is the same as the likelihood of getting the fifth. Is that sort of what you find there?
Well, they're less likely to score a fifth simply just because it's harder, but there's no statistics. Difference. They've always been less likely to score a fifth.
Sure. Yeah.
So it wasn't like the bonus point came in and now all of a sudden they're statistically less likely to score a fifth try. It's just by nature, five is harder than four. So we control for so much as well. We control for the teams, the seeds. We control for what's the group outcome. So is it a case that a team is already qualified so they mightn't be playing their first 15, or is it the case that are already eliminated, or is it the case that this is a crucial match? We control for the weather conditions. You know, was it raining on the day? So is it harder to score a try? Was it windy? So is kicking less likely? Yeah, so that was actually, because my job, part of my job was the data collection, and it was quite tricky. But we have hundreds of controls, and when you control for all of that, you'll find that, yeah, well, actually the bonus point does work. And it also doesn't lead to a fall off in effort. It's not the case that once they achieve this, they're just then managing the game out. Or
just before we move on, then you mentioned the issue of crowds. Have you done any research on that and how, like, the effect? Because you hear anecdotally that, you know, the home game, the home advantage, and all that sort of stuff. But is there a statistical effect, or is that something that's not really tested?
So you will find statistical effects in home crowd advantage. I've read papers on that. A paper we had, which kind of touched on it was our paper a couple of years ago on Fergie time. So you might have seen me present that. But our paper on Fergie time, what we wanted to see was Fergie time real. And one of the controls we had in there was attendance, match attendance. Now, it's not a perfect measure because, like, you know, some crowds are more vocal than others. Some supporters are more passionate than others. So, you know, Roy Keane famously criticised Manchester United supporters and there's not enough atmosphere in the stadium. And
Prawn Sandwich Brigade, was that the...
You that was exactly it, you remembered it. So his argument was that even though United were at home, the atmosphere that was being generated in Old Trafford was the advantage it might be at other grounds. And you might even find that some stadiums in different occasions tend to behave differently. So they often say Anfield on a European night. You know, Anfield is always... or the atmosphere always seems to be special, but particularly special in European football. And then you get places like Newcastle, you know, notoriously passionate fans. Sunderland, who are in the Premier League as well, notoriously passionate. So you could have Old Trafford that has 76,000 supporters, and it may not compare the same as, you know, 50,000 at St. James's Park, 15,000 at Bournemouth. But they do, the papers and research does find home advantage exists through crowd effects. The closer the teams are to the pitch, the more likely there is to be home advantage. And that was measured using, I think my memory is correct, the number of yellow cards and red cards given to home and away teams.
Oh, interesting.
The supporters were nearer to the referee, physically nearer. He was more likely to caution away players.
Okay, so that would be like you had older pitches, I suppose, which were probably you're right in on top of the team.
Yeah, and I think it was done for Serie A, and the thinking behind it was there's a number of Serie A pitches that have a running track going around it. So the Stadio Olimpico does, and I think that was the initial rationale for it. So, well, are Lazio and Roma at a disadvantage at home because the supporters are, you know, 50 yards away from the referee, and then they might already be. Whereas if your pitch is, you know, if the touchline is 2 yards away from the assistant referee, can the assistant referee be pressurized? And I think what you're going to see now, because the Premier League is just so surreal at the moment, you're going to see some really nice papers come out, because I don't know if this will hold up statistically, but anecdotally, I think there's less cautions. I'm not sure, has there been a red card yet?
And so you mentioned your Fergie time. Now, maybe you could remind us what Fergie time was and what the bias is there.
Yes, again, the rationale for that one was, I remember watching Manchester City against Man United in that famous game in 2009 or 10 when Michael Owen...
I remember that game when Owen scored the goal in the last minute.
Yeah, and Craig Bellamy had equalised in injury time. And I think... there were 4 minutes of injury time to be played. And Bellamy scored after 3:28 or something. There was literally seconds left. And he obviously celebrated, and then the game restarted. And Owen scored the winning goal on 5:51, I think. So there was nearly 2 minutes extra played. Now, Bellamy scored with about 30 seconds to go. So even factoring in celebration, there was still 30 seconds left, and I think there was another 90 played after. And I guess that was the kind of tipping point where I said, God, you know, I'm starting to think this is actually real. You know, maybe this thing is real, because people talked about it for years, because Manchester United were so good at scoring late goals.
So that the referees were bound to Ferguson's sort of the pressure and his aura.
Well, it was the belief that Ferguson had a kind of, he had an ability to influence the amount of time added on.
Yeah.
So it might be 4 minutes instead of three, or it might be 5 minutes instead of four. And also that not only would they add on a little bit more, they then play beyond it. So we collected all the data. We got 3 seasons of data. We got every game, because you can't just do it for Man United. You have to see it for every team. And we couldn't find it. We couldn't find any evidence. We did find a small bit of bias towards bigger teams when they were losing, but only when the match was already decided. So what I mean by that is they were losing by at least 2 goals. Then they might get 4, 5, 6 minutes. But in games, that could be decided by one goal. So if the game was drawn or if there was one goal between the teams either way, we couldn't find any evidence that there was, or the referees weren't being impartial. So, you know, it was an endorsement of what the referees were doing. You might see Man United score a late goal against City. You might see them get 90 seconds more than we thought they might get. But if these things happen, they are very, very rare. Mm. Don't have any statistically standing, if that makes sense, in terms of any difference what might normally happen.
Yeah, so just to drill a bit deeper then, so you got all the data for all the different games. Did you estimate what the probability of added time was in each game and compare?
So what you have to do then, again, you have to control for everything. So you have to control for the number of substitutes, you have to control for the number of yellow cards, red cards, serious injuries, who the referee is, who the teams are, who's playing at home, number between. And again, once you have all these controls in there, you're kind of then isolating the effect. So what you'll find is lots of things were statistically significant that you'd expect. So substitutions added time on, it was about 12 seconds. A red card added a little bit on. A serious injury was the most significant, because naturally it would. If a player is down for 6, 7, 8 minutes, you're naturally going to get 7, 8, 9 minutes of injury time. Lots of the things that we expected to be significant were. There was one interesting finding, is that the margin between the teams was negative. And again, it was something I expected to find, because what you'll often find is if a team is beating another team comfortably, so let's suppose Chelsea are at home to Burnley and are winning 5-0, and then they'll go to the board and they say, oh, there's 1 minute of added time or 2 minutes of added time. And it's almost as if the referee is kind of, you know, putting the losers out of their misery. And again, I remember thinking, but, you know, the referee should be impartial here. The added time is the added time. If there's 3 minutes or 4 minutes or 6 minutes, that's what the added time is. So we did find that. So when a game was decided, the amount of added time is significantly lower. But in terms of giving extra time, we didn't find anything. We found referees were impartial.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
One thing that we mentioned before we went on air was in relation to that, in terms of betting odds and the probability of a draw being maybe undervalued relative to maybe other things. Maybe you could talk about that a bit. Like, I always think about All-Ireland finals, and that if we're anywhere we're close to a draw, the referee will play for the draw nearly, or you get that sense that that's what's going to happen. But when it comes to the betting odds, perhaps people maybe undervalue the value of a draw relative to maybe other outcomes.
I think you hit on a couple of brilliant things there, and try and recall them. But I think in hurling, there wasn't a draw for decades, 40, 50 years or something. And then I think we've had two or three draws in the last 10 years. Remember Kilkenny and Galway drew, and it was the first draw in ages. And there's been a couple of them since. And I think you're right to say that if a game is tight, there will be that little bit of extra time played. And there's almost an opportunity for teams to equalise. So if a team behind is on the attack, the referee will naturally leave them play out. And if they miss, it's kind of a case as well, look, you had an opportunity. And my colleague, John Constantine, UCC, has done a little bit of blogging on that. And what is anecdotally is what you'll find is that if you're losing, you're more likely to get frees for things like too many steps or holding. Or whereas if you're winning, you're more likely to concede frees for these reasons. So there's an element that, you know, they're trying to balance up a little bit.
And there are reasons where there's a bit of judgment, a bit of discretion.
Yeah, look, you know, we all suffer from these behavioural biases, and it may be subconscious, but I guess you're just trying to give teams an opportunity. It can have a significant outcome on the game, because particularly in Gaelic games, momentum is very important. And a team is winning by 4, 5, 6 points and then has easy frees given against them, you know, that can be chipped away. 6 can become 5, 5 can be 4, and so on. And there's a bit of momentum building. And maybe that's why you're seeing more draws. To bring it to our paper, so it's the one we've had accepted most recently. It's with John Eakins and David Butler in UCC. We looked at pundit predictions, and we wanted to see if the pundits actually knew what they were talking about. And we did this for the Premier League for 3 seasons between 2015 and 2018. And we collected 3,500 observations from the pundits. The likes of Paul Merson and Matt Letizia and Charlie Nicholas, the guys you see regularly on Sky Sports, and Mark Lawrence in BBC. And we just wanted to see, you know, how do these guys fare? So we were then able to compare them to a website called Superbrew. And Superbrew is a game that I hadn't heard of it. My co-author found it, John Eakins. And he said, well, look, we have this game. It's online. Anyone can play it. It's for free, where people predict Premier League matches. And we had 8 million players and over 32 million observations. So what we could do was we could compare the pundit predictions to just the average guy, just like me or you, to see, well, do the pundits actually know what they're talking about? So that's the first kind of test we did. And we found that, yes, in fact, the pundits were better. They were better than ordinary people at picking the outcome of games. And where they were better was in the outcome of draws. So ordinary people don't tend to like to pick draws. So Man United play Sheffield United. Man United are going to win. Other people that don't like Man United will say Sheffield United will win. There's a natural tendency to deviate away from the draw because the neutral outcome, people feel like they're not predicting anything, when in fact they are. But because it's the neutral outcome, it's less popular. So about 1 in 10 games in the Premier League end in the draw, in a 0-0 draw. And the incidence of 0-0 predictions is about 1 in 100.
If you're putting down a bet, there's good value in the 0-0 draw.
Well, what you'll find is a 0-0 draw will usually be probably about 7 or 8 to 1. Now, if it happens 1 in 10, you're going to lose money. And on average, it's going to happen 1 in 10. And this is the beauty of the betting odds. I mean, the betting odds are factoring in almost everything. Almost, and I say almost because the pundits could marginally outperform the betting markets. So if you followed a pundit and just backed the home draw away outcome that they predicted, you would actually have beaten the bookies slightly. Not a huge profit, but slightly. The average person couldn't beat the bookie. So the pundits do know something that the rest of us don't know. And then we took it a step further and we actually looked at the match outcome, because what they do is they'll predict the outcome. They won't just say Spurs are going to win. They're going to say Spurs will win 3-1. But even the pundits can't do the scorecasts. So if you follow the pundit, you follow the scorecast, you lose money. It's just too complex. There's too many moving variables. So betting on match outcomes, as in trying to predict the score of the match, is an extremely complex task. And it's likely if you do that, you're going to lose money.
And I imagine for soccer as well, when it's such a thick market and everybody's, there's a lot of resources going in to on the side of the bookies to try and making sure that they're efficient in terms of their odds. I imagine if you want to make money, you want to beat the bookies, you want to do it in an area where you know more than them. And maybe if you went down to your local Junior B GAA pitch or whatever, I don't know, but...
I think where you could potentially, well, definitely lose less money is in drawn outcomes. So the prediction of drawn outcomes seem to happen more frequently than most people estimate. And you could get lucky. You could back nil-nils or one-alls, and you could get two or three nil-nils in a weekend or two or three one-alls. In football, the most regular scoreline is 1-0. The second most regular scoreline is 1-1. The third most regular scoreline is 0-1. And the fourth most regular is 0-0. So the four most likely outcomes have no goals, one goal or two goals. Whereas when people back scorecasts, even when pundits predict things, they'll say things like 2-2 or 3-2 or 3-0 or 4-1. And unfortunately, football isn't that exciting, I'm afraid.
No, yeah, definitely. I think our own bias there, what we want to happen, maybe influences what we think might happen. So another thing that you've worked on that's quite interesting, and I think it was the first time I was aware of this work that you guys do, is on like the cutoff for underage football. It resonated with me because like I was never much of a footballer, but the only time I ever got my game was when my birthday is in March, so I got an extra year, and by default I got my game then that year. But basically, I think your analysis was to look at for that cutoff and people at the upper end, maybe perhaps some more developed.
Yeah, so we weren't the first to look at this, and we're definitely not going to be the last, because loads of people are looking at it. It originated about 100 years ago, nearly, where researchers started looking at children going into primary school to see if older children were more capable than younger children, and no surprise, they were. And what they found was that this persisted for some time, but eventually it faded. And the reason it faded was because schooling was compulsory. So it was just a convergence, a little bit like countries growing. You find that countries converge to a certain level of GDP. So in school, you might have been born in January, I might have been born in December. There's 12 months between us, so almost. We're in the same class. You are miles ahead of me when we're in junior infants, senior infants, and as it goes on. But by the time we get to fifth, sixth class, or even secondary school, there is no difference. Then people started doing it for sport, and no surprise, they found exactly the same thing, because being born earlier in the calendar year was a proxy for physique. And that's what whilst it's called a relative age effect, what it should really call is a relative physique effect, because you assume somebody that's born 11 or 10 or 12 months earlier than someone else is just physically stronger. So again, they found it, and they found it in every sport they looked at: soccer, rugby, cricket. I mean, you'll find it in horse racing, because horses are bred to be born in the earlier months of the year, January, February, March, because every horse has a date of birth of the 1st of January. So you don't want a horse to be born, you know, in June, July, August, simply because by the end of that year, the horse will be technically one. And if it's going to run as a two-year-old or a three-year-old, it's going to be only 2.5 or 3.5 or 1.5, as the case might be. So it was found in soccer, no surprise, and in sport. And it was found in gymnastics as well, which is really interesting, because the effect was the opposite in gymnastics. You were better off to be born in December, because being smaller in gymnastics is an advantage. But the problem you have with sport that you don't have at school is that dropout is possible. Whereas you don't drop out of school, or the vast majority of children don't. In sport, dropout is really easy. And what they were finding is kids were just dropping out because they couldn't compete. So we found this in soccer, we found it in Irish under 21 internationals, and we found that, you know, this was just January, February, March, April, all the way down to December. The problem with that, the problem we couldn't publish that, was because that had been found so many times across so many countries. So where my co-author David had an inspired idea was, he said, well, in Ireland, the cutoff used to be the 1st of August, and it was when I was a child. And in 1997, it changed. So I played the first 15 years of my life under an August cutoff. And then when I was 15, it went to a January cutoff. So he had the idea, well, let's go back and look at the under-21s that played under the August cutoff. So we went and collected that data, and we had a right job at collecting that, because most of that data is not available online. And again, he had another inspired decision. He went up to our attic and he found old programs, matches that my father would have had. And what you'll find in a program, and I suggest you do this the next time we're able to go to a match, when you have a program, just look at the dates of birth. And it doesn't matter if this is hurling or rugby or soccer, because it's usually the name and the date of birth. And a remarkable amount of them will be born in the first quarter. The vast majority will probably be born in the first half of the year. So somewhere from January to June. And in some cases, they might all be born in that part of the year. But we went and collected data prior to the cutoff. And what did we find? Prior to the change, the advantage was for August, September, October. So being born in January wasn't an advantage. Being born in August was. And we joked at the time because Roy Keane was born in August. So I think it was the 4th of August. So it was the perfect time to be born under that cutoff. As you take, I think Ronaldo was born in February. And again, for Ronaldo, that was the perfect month to be born, or almost perfect. And that's how we got it published, because now we have this lovely natural experiment. It's nothing to do with January. It's to do when you have the cutoff. And then it does beg to the question, well, this is sort of inevitable in many ways, because it's just a matter of where you slice it. And how you overcome it is you try and train coaches to say, well, look, it's all about physique. It's not all about winning right now. It's about trying to get players to play a certain way so that when they're 18, 19, 20, and they're physically the same, they're all still in the game.
So the coach's incentive is to win the game, and then they say, right, this guy's a big guy here. Now you have to go in hard for the tackles or whatever, and that's the way we're going to win the game, as opposed to maybe taking the longer term approach and trying to focus on the skills.
I guess it's just the coach, because the coach always gets to kind of wrap here. It's the kids as well want to win the game. So it's not just the coach saying, we want to win this. The kids just want to win the game. So the kids have no interest per se in developing the other kids that are not, you know, up to the standard. They just want the best team on the pitch because they just want to win the game. And I was that kid. I'm sure you were that kid when you played as well. So the coach wants to win. The parents want to win. The kids want to win. But trying to get them all on the same page is very, very difficult because they don't think about years down the line. How could they? And again, this is not an Irish problem either. This is a problem that's throughout Europe. So Spain has this problem, and Spain plays wonderful football and has been doing so for, you know, 15 years at this stage nearly. Netherlands has this problem. Belgium has this problem. But I think identifying it and knowing it's there and trying to educate people that it is there is the first step. And it's particularly the first step for a kid that is a good player and he or she cannot get into a team just because they're not physically strong enough, and to tell them to stick at it.
And on foot of that, then, you're saying you're working with the FAI. Could you tell us a bit about that, maybe?
They're really moving in a really positive direction in terms of research and trying to understand the game in Ireland. And I guess our work on relative age, because we would have presented that to them, and they're very much aware of this. And they're interested in analysing the data that we're creating, because FAI has done in the last 10 years or so is roll out underage leagues. What you will find is the lower you go, the more likely you are to get a relative age effect. You just need to be very much aware that when you are down dealing with 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds and they're playing League of Ireland soccer for Cork or Shamrock Rovers or Waterford or Galway, whatever the case might be, it's really important that you manage expectations of coaches and players and parents to ensure that you are developing the player.
Okay, my own thoughts on the broadcasting thing is that before, when it was the subscription type model, we had one provider and it was Sky. And now we're moving on to maybe more than one provider. And it seems that for the consumer, there's no benefit to this competition because we now have to pay for more than one service. Whereas for the producer of it, it's perfect because they've sort of divided up their product and had people bidding against each other for divisions of that product. So they're maybe maximizing the rents that they're getting and then eking into maybe our consumer surplus or whatever. But you've done work on the broadcasting. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
I think you've summed that up perfectly, because this is not going to change, because it's in the interest of the seller. Because the Premier League maximizes broadcasting revenue, and broadcasting revenue has exploded in the last 30 years. And the agreement in 1992 with the Premier League and the arrival of Sky changed everything. And prior to that, games were on free-to-air television. And actually, it's quite amazing that the first free-to-air TV game in nearly 30 years was on Friday night on BBC. And it was the first time BBC had a free-to-air match in the Premier League ever, and in top-flight football since 1988. ITV took it off them prior to Sky coming in. So what's happened there is what has driven the exorbitant increase in transfer fees and players' salaries. So long as the broadcasting revenue sustains itself, there's no bubble per se in what's happening. If the broadcasting revenue were to dry up, it would change everything. And I think experiences of the last number of months have demonstrated that probably most people thought could never happen, that you could have Premier League matches played in empty stadiums. And I would teach this in sports economics in UCC and teach the fact that, look, ticket sales are nice in the sense that they're a form of revenue, but they're not the most important part of club revenue at the elite end. In fact, the more ticket revenue becomes important, the less elite the club is. So when you rely on ticket revenue as in going through the gate, it's a precarious position to be in, because it's very variable, it's very volatile. And you're relying on a very narrow window of about an hour to generate revenue for 2 weeks. So League of Ireland is largely reliant on ticket sales. If you go down the leagues, League One, League Two in England, it's people going in to pay in. The further you go up, the more it's about broadcasting. But the other really interesting thing now that we can now witness is that it is not the same without spectators in the stadium. It's a much diminished product. And it feels different.
They have these fake crowd noises as well.
What that demonstrates is that the supporter is actually paying for the product that they create. So it's a very unique relationship, that when you pay for a product, you usually just get that product and you use it, right? But the supporter is part of the atmosphere, and the atmosphere that's created is what makes the game good. So they are paying for something that they create themselves. It's not dissimilar to going to a pub, I suppose, that, you know, we're all part of the atmosphere in the pub, and that's what makes it feel good. But you're creating that yourself, a small part of it, albeit, but you are creating it. Now, for most pubs, you don't pay to get into. So you don't have to pay to create what you're creating. But sport is different. And maybe, who knows, this will change things. And supporters groups will now pressure owners and say, well, look, ticket prices should be reduced because we are critical to this product. We are part of the spectacle. And I don't think supporters would ever be left in for free. But leaving them in for free would be much, much better than the spectacle that we have right now.
If I was running a club, I'd be setting the ticket price. I'd be making sure that I can fill the stadium, definitely. And I'd be setting the ticket price, the maximum price that gets the stadium full. But then you think about, well, you want to make sure you get the hardcore fans in, because they're the ones who are going to be making the most noise and creating the atmosphere. So maybe you want to segregate. You want to maybe allocate certain number of tickets to your season ticket holders who come from the supporters club versus the pro on sandwich brigade, who are maybe just going to stick quiet in the big box or whatever.
No, you're right, because clubs do have this. They have special sections of the ground that are cordoned off for singing sections or noisier sections. So they are attempting to do this. What the research shows is that the vast majority of owners, and this is US research, so owners of franchises, price the tickets in the inelastic portion of the demand curve. And by that they mean is if they raise price, it would actually raise total revenue. So it could charge more, right, and just choose not to. Now, there's a number of reasons or thinking behind that. One is that they have so much money, they don't really care about the profit the club is generating. Empathy with the fans is another one. Another theory is that it's pressure from fans, that, you know, supporters pressure them to keep tickets low. Another theory is that, well, actually, it's a loss leader. So your ticket isn't as expensive as it might be, but your beer and your pie and your burger are overpriced. So there are a number of different theories behind that. We've seen people object, supporters groups object to ticket prices, rising ticket prices. Liverpool did it 3 or 4 years ago. There was a walkout near the end of the match. Bayern Munich fans did it famously in the Champions League when they went to the Emirates. They complained about the price of tickets for Arsenal and Bayern Munich. Ticket prices in Germany are generally much, much lower than they are in England. So, yeah, I think you might see a fallout from this, is that tickets might become a bit cheaper.
Yeah, and I wonder then, in terms of the whole broadcasting model, like, how sustainable is that long run?
At the moment, there is an insatiable demand for live sport, and it doesn't matter what sport it is. If it's GAA in Ireland, we've seen the GAA move from free to air, which it always was, be it RTE or TG Cahir or TV3, to subscription with Sky and Air Sport and providers like that. And you've seen it in the Premier League previous. And if you take the Premier League model, it was Sky, it's now Sky and BT and Amazon. So there is no shortage of people wanting to buy this content. Sport is becoming unique in the sense that it's one of the few things now that brings people together to watch things. So people will actually sit down and watch an All-Ireland semi-final together or a Munster final. It's one of the few things people view by appointment. What I mean by that is the residual value to sport, as in I'll go onto the planner and watch it. Nobody does that, or almost nobody. You watch it live and then you probably never watch it again. So it's one of the very few things now that we actually say, well, what time is it on? And it's on at 8 o'clock, it's on at 7:30, it's on at 4 o'clock, and you sit there and watch it. Most other things like the news or soaps they might watch, you know, they just will wait and will I get the box set or I just download it from Netflix. So it's starting to fulfill a quite unique space in the broadcasting schedule. And the other thing is that if you go back, look historically at this, there were very few channels. So the sports providers actually had no bargaining power. So the suppliers of the channels held all the power. And they demanded the content they want. We now live in an environment where you literally have hundreds and hundreds of channels. So there is an insatiable demand for content. And because there are so many channels, because they all need content all of the time, there is no reason to suggest why this model is under any pressure. What you might find is a leveling off, because there was an example of, they believed it was a winner's curse. In the case of the Premier League, it's a sealed bid auction. So you only get to bid once and you don't know what others are bidding. So there's a chance you'll overbid.
Like a first price sealed bid auction or?
First price sealed bid. So there's a chance you'll overbid. And Sky has always had pole position in the Premier League, even though that they share it, first of all, with Setanta Sports, then with ESPN, then BT, and now BT and Amazon. They've always held pole position. They've always had Super Sunday. And Sunday is regarded as the primetime slot. 4 o'clock on a Sunday. They've never given that up. If you want to make sure you're going to keep that, you have to bid high because you don't know what someone else will bid. Now, whether you overbid, who knows? The most recent round of bidding, which was 19-20 to 21-22, it was about the same as 16-19. So you have a kind of a sense that we probably bid an awful lot. It was 4.8 billion in 2016. For the three seasons. It was about the same in 2019. There had been a big jump from 2010 to 2014, a big jump. You might find in the world that we now live in, when the next round is negotiated, not a significant reduction, but you might find reduction.
No, I just wondering, just when you're talking about the bidding process, like, is it one bundle or multiple bundles?
So there's seven different packages. originally there were six packages, and this is where the whole issue came to a head, is that in 1992, when Sky got access to 60 matches at the time, I think it was, they had all 60. And then that went up to 110, 120. And you might recall in the early noughties, they had what was called Prem Plus, which was pay-per-view. So if you had the Sky basic packages in Sky Sports, there were still some matches you couldn't watch. They were on this pay-per-view channel. But the European Commission ruled in 2006 that this was anti-competitive, because there was a company with a monopoly, and they said it ran against European competition law. And they said from the 2006-07 season, there had to be competition. So there were six packages, and they said one provider could buy a maximum of five. So Sky did exactly that in 2006. They bought five, and Setanta bought one. So, but Setanta was short-lived because of the financial crisis. So Setanta had it for two seasons, and the final season was sold to ESPN. And then it rolled over in 2010, and again, Sky bought five and ESPN had one. That was okay in Ireland because you got ESPN free through Sky, so there was no big deal, right? If you were in the UK, you had to pay for ESPN. But in Ireland, things changed when BT came in 2013, because BT bought one package, 23 games, and Sky had the remainder. But now you had to pay extra for BT. And it was then I thought, you know, I don't know, it's competition. Actually helpful, but it's not competition at all. It's different monopolies in different markets.
Maybe we could finish off. I think you've done some work on horse racing, if you want to discuss that.
So the paper we have, that it's a working paper, it's not quite ready to go. I'm presenting it virtually at the North American Sports Economics Association conference next week, and I don't know how that's going to go down, because it's British horse racing, and we wanted to see whether or not elite jockeys justified their salaries. So jockeys normally are freelance. And what you mean by freelance is they can ride any horse. So if they ride freelance, they get the riding fee, which is £120, and they get a percentage of the prize money if they finish in the prize money. And the percentage declines then whether they finish first or in places. But the most elite jockeys have what are called retainer contracts. So what a retainer contract does is it ties them to a particular owner. And these are the elite owners. They are they're horses that run in famous colours like Godolphin, like Khalid Abdullah, like Sheikh Amal Al Maktoum, Frankel colours for Khalid Abdullah. And jockeys, you know, the likes of Frankie Dettori, the likes of Paul Hannigan, Jim Crowley, Oisin Murphy, the elite jockeys in the sport. So what we've been able to do is, again, collect data. We have 12 years of data on this one, and we can look at their income and the number of mounts they had and a productivity measure. And the beauty of the productivity measure is we didn't create it. It's an algorithm that's run by a company called Racing Research. And they won't tell us how the algorithm actually worked, but you could pay for it, but it costs quite a lot of money. But that doesn't matter too much. What they've kindly done is given us their data, because you have to pay for the data. And they've given it to us for free for the academic research. It controls for everything, basically. And when a horse finishes in a race, it will tell you the contribution that the jockey made to the horse. So if you're a jockey and you're riding the favourite and the horse wins, and people say, well, wasn't the jockey great? Well, the algorithm goes one step beyond that and says, well, how much should the horse have won by?
Based on all its previous performance.
Exactly, all the previous performance, given the conditions, distance, the ground, the opposition. And what they might actually find is, well, should have won by greater distance. So in that case, the jockey then is given a slightly negative score, right? So you could be riding a 50-1 shot and you could finish third. And even though you finish third, that jockey gets an enhanced score, because racing research would assume that that horse would have done poorer, right? So that's the beauty of that productivity measure. And then we control for all the obvious controls, the venue, the track, the course, the trainer, the conditions, the weight, the odds. And what we found is that elite jockeys, just like the pundits in our paper, are actually elite. They do perform statistically better than they should, even taking into account that they ride the best horses for the best owners and they're riding favourites. They do that little bit ever again, and significantly so. And we also find that when they leave these retainer contracts, and some of them do because they just become so good, they don't even need a retainer contract. And Frankie Dettori is a good example of that. They kind of ride freelance. They pick and choose. They still do better. So they kind of have this legacy effect where because they've been a high-profile elite jockey riding with a retainer, they can now come off that retainer, owners still pick, they know they're kind of elite or they have this kind of aura about them.
I'd wonder then what is driving their like elite. Is it a thing that like there could be the obvious reason that they're just better, basically, and that's fair enough? Or is there just like a feedback effect that if you are in with a good crowd and then you end up doing well because of that, because you're around, you've got good people around you, people treat you well, and then that means that you end up doing a bit better. I wonder, is there a way to get at that with your data? Maybe look at, I don't know, control for these sort of facts.
They must be picked for a reason. So they must be identified for a reason. And when they're picked, they do then overperform. Now, it might be, as you say, just being treated better, you know, being having better access to facilities or services, or maybe it's confidence. I'm not sure. Our racing research measure captures all of that because they're still outperforming. Does that make sense? So even though the best horses for the best owners and the shortest odds, so they should be winning more, they're still winning significantly more than they might otherwise do.
It's hard to know how you would actually get at that.
And as I said, I don't know. I don't understand. My interest in horse racing is purely as a spectator. I don't understand the mechanics of that side of the industry.
Of course, yeah, no, of course. No, it's just something that came to mind there when you were talking about it. That's everything I have on the list. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to cover or...
No, I think you've...
All right, well, thanks a million, Robbie. That was great.
No, you're welcome. Thanks very much.
My thanks to Robbie, and hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Don't forget to share with friends or family if you enjoy. A 5-star review on Apple Podcasts always helps to spread the word. And if you want to chip in to cover costs, the Patreon is at www.patreon.com/IrishEconPod. Okay, well, thanks for listening and all the best.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.